You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. On today's show, we're talking health history, Super Bowl snacks, listener challenges, and more. Stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey, gang. Welcome to Dana's Low Carb for Life. On this week's show, we're going to get to the second half of my interview with Adele Height, who worked for a long time with Dr. Eric Westman, who is one of the country's leading low-carb researchers. She's now studying nutrition, and you'll find it pretty interesting what she has to say about her nutrition studies. It's eye-opening. You want to hear that. We're going to be hearing another listener challenge, and we're going to talk a bit about Super Bowl party snacks. You're going to want to hear all about that. But first, I want to talk to you about a little health history. Now, we've all heard Satayana's saying that those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it, and it is sadly true. I was put in mind of a particular instance of this occurring while writing a recent blog post at holdthetoast.com, so I thought I'd talk to you about it. Do you know where the disease malaria got its name? What the name means? It means bad air, malaria. Now, malaria was called this because it was believed that the disease was caused by breathing noxious-smelling air, swamp air, or night air. This belief was based on something called the miasmatic theory of disease. Now, it was believed that a miasma was a vapor or a mist that arose from decomposing matter. Many diseases, it wasn't just malaria, many diseases were blamed on miasma. During the Middle Ages, for instance, people carried little posies of flowers and herbs that they could sniff to block out bad smells in an attempt to ward off the plague. That's where we got the line, "the pocket full of posies" in the childhood rhyme. Cholera outbreaks in Victorian London were blamed on the stench that arose from the sewage-filled water of the Thames, while malaria and also yellow fever were blamed on the night air coming off of the marshes and the swamps in the southern United States and other swampy areas. So, people in low-lying, swampy areas learned to close their shutters at dusk against that dangerous night air, also shutting out the mosquitoes that actually carried the disease, while anyone who could get away from the foulness of London in the summer would head to country districts where the air smelled sweeter and there were coincidentally fewer people pooping in the water supply, fewer rats running around with fleas on them that bit people. And if, as it seems likely, the people who did these things had a lower rate of the diseases in question, it was viewed as validating this miasmatic theory. Of course, the miasmatic theory was pure bunk. The reduction in disease rates were purely coincidental. Similarly, what happens today when people decide they're going to eat healthy? They've heard that fat is bad, that fat is the dietary enemy. They've heard that fast food is bad, supposedly because it's high in fat. They've heard fried stuff is bad because it's fatty. They've heard that vegetables are good for them. So they cut back on the fast food meals, and they not only cut out some fat, but also great huge whacks of carbohydrate in the bun and the Coke and the fries, or the hot apple pie or whatever. They trade in the donut they've been having for breakfast, because after all, it's fried and high fat and all that, for oatmeal, thus not only getting rid of the hideously damaged cheap frying oil that most donuts are made in, but also trading in white flour and sugar for at least somewhat less dangerous grain foods with usually substantially less sugar, unless they're eating instant oatmeal, the flavored instant oatmeal, then all bets are off. Maybe they decide they'll get the main dish salad for lunch and thus skip the bread and the fries that would have come with the sandwich. And they feel better. Their health markers improve a bit. They lose a little weight. And they're quite certain that is because they're eating a lower fat diet. But it's no truer than it was that not breathing night air would prevent malaria. As anyone who has screens knows, you can breathe all the night air you want, and so long as you don't get bitten by mosquitoes, you're not going to get malaria. Likewise, cutting out the worst high-fat junk food may very well improve your health, but it's not because you're eating a low-fat diet. It's because you've cut out the worst junk carbs, most of which also have some fat in them, and you're also cutting out the highly damaged vegetable oils that fried stuff is mostly cooked with. As those of us who deliberately eat 65% or more of our calories from fat know, a high-fat diet is actually terrific for health so long as you're eating traditional and unprocessed fats and not getting a whole bunch of carbs with it. Sadly, these are the same people who will wind up saying, well, I tried diet and exercise, but it just wasn't enough. So now my doctor wants me to take this or that medication. Their diet wasn't enough because they were focusing on the wrong diet. Okay, in a few minutes, we're going to hear from a listener about her biggest low-carb challenge, and I'm really pleased that people are starting to call in. This is great. But first, we need to talk about the next special date on your calendar. We already talked about Girl Scout cookie time. And of course, Valentine's Day is coming up soon, so we'll talk about that next week. But we have another big day in between. Super Bowl Sunday is coming up. Quite a lot of the nation is going to be glued to their TV sets all day long, and lots of food is part of the Super Bowl tradition. Now, to be honest, I could not care less about the Super Bowl. I'm just not into games. I'm not into professional sports. And furthermore, as a professional massage therapist, I cannot watch all those 300-pound guys run sideways into each other's knees. I know way too well what they're doing to themselves. And frankly, that nice boy I married is not that big into sports either. We have actually been known to host a Let's Ignore the Super Bowl party. Still, I am good at low-carb party strategy, so let's talk about what to serve on game day. You'll want to make sure that there are plenty of snacks that work for you. If you're going to someone else's house for a party, volunteer to bring something. And if the party's at your house, you've got lots and lots of choices that are not only easy, they're also very crowd-pleasing. I mean, let's face it, what group of football fans wouldn't rather have hot wings than celery with fat-free dip? Now, if you don't feel like working too hard on this, you can just rely on your grocery store deli to provide all the low-carb snacks you could possibly need. I've checked at my local grocery stores, and at the delis you can get, first of all, chicken wing platters. You want to watch out for breading and sugary sauces on chicken wings. If you really have to pick one or the other, a small quantity of sauce is better than the breading, which is not only carby, but is also going to have damaged fats. It is nice to know that traditional buffalo sauce is very low carb. So if you can get a buffalo wing platter, go for it. You can, of course, get a cheese platter with slices or cubes of cheese, or a cold cut platter, and you can put out bread or rolls or whatever for the people who want to eat carbs, and you can just eat your cold cuts with mustard and mayo sandwiched between the slice of ham and cheese. What the heck? It's called an unsandwich. You can also get shrimp platters. Now, if you're going to do this, you might want to take up a collection from your guests, because let's face it, shrimp is pricey. But it's also nice to know you can make low-carb cocktail sauce very easily by simply spiking sugar-free ketchup with horseradish and lemon juice to taste. So go for the shrimp platter. You can also get the relish tray, and it's always nice to have the celery and the baby carrots and all that stuff. I like that stuff. But my local delis also carry the antipasto platter. Kroger, the biggest grocery chain in the country, lists this on their website. So I have a feeling this is pretty commonly available. The antipasto platter includes olives, peppers, artichokes, marinated mushrooms, and a fresh mozzarella and tomato salad, and every bit of that works for us. Marsh, which is my other local big grocery store chain, has what's called a Mediterranean bar, and it has all of these things plus some other things like feta cheese, and, you know, you scoop it into containers, and then you just have to supply the platter. If the gang at your house, or wherever you are, wants to order pizza, make sure that one of those pies, first of all, has extra cheese, and secondly, is loaded with all your favorite low-carb toppings. when the pizza comes, snag your slices, put them on a plate, and hide them. Stash them out of reach for 5 minutes. You're letting them cool a little bit so you can handle the cheese itself without burning yourself. And you know perfectly well that if you just leave it in the box and wait for the pizza to cool, someone's going to eat your slices. So put your slices on a plate and hide them. Then, when they've cooled enough that you can peel off the cheese in just one piece, peel off the toppings, eat them without the edible napkin, also known as the crust. I've done this at a million parties, eaten just the toppings and thrown away the crust, and nobody even cares. Perhaps you'd like to make something yourself. Us women, especially if the party is at our house, often feel that we have to represent and make a little something ourselves. So here are some ideas. You could make no bean chili, or you could make chili with soybeans in it. I don't eat a lot of soy. I'm not a real big soy fan. I do sometimes put a can of black soybeans in my chili. Either way, keep your chili hot in your slow cooker, and people can nosh on it all afternoon. You can, of course, make your own wings. There's a wonderful recipe, the very first recipe in 500 low-carb recipes, my first cookbook. It's called Heroin Wings, and it's a recipe for chicken wings breaded with seasoned Parmesan cheese, and it's insanely great, and everybody always loves them. But it is a little complicated, takes a little time, takes a little work. If you want to do something really easy, you can just roast a bunch of wings till they're crispy and toss them with buffalo sauce. And if you'd like to make your own buffalo sauce, it's nice to know that the canonical recipe for buffalo sauce is half and half mixture of melted butter and Frank's Louisiana hot sauce. You can use Tabasco or another Louisiana-style hot sauce, but Frank's is the original. Very, very easy to do. You can always make stuffed mushrooms. Stuffed mushrooms are low-carb. They're great. Well, it depends on what you stuff them with, of course. You want to leave out the breadcrumbs. But you can. There are all sorts of low-carb things you can stuff into mushrooms. You can do tuna fish. You can do crab. You can do sausage. You can do hamburger. You can do cheese. You can do all sorts of great things stuffed into mushrooms. And the mushrooms themselves are very low-carb. There are a lot of things you can do with low-carb tortillas. You could make tortilla pizzas on the low-carb tortillas, and you just use jarred pizza sauce. You want to read the label and make sure you're getting one that doesn't have any corn syrup or sugar in it. Ragu makes a sugar-free pizza sauce. They also make pizza quick sauce, which does have sugar in it, so you want to read the labels. But get a sugar-free pizza sauce and then shredded mozzarella cheese and some toppings and stuff, and just put them on a cookie sheet and bake them at 400 until the cheese is starting to brown, and you've got a tortilla pizza. You can make quesadillas with your low-carb tortillas. Everybody loves those. You can also do burritos or soft tacos. It's really easy to set up a burrito or a soft taco bar. You just set out your meat filling, make a meat taco filling, and then warm up some canned refried beans for the people who eat that stuff. And then, you know, the shredded cheese, the shredded lettuce, the diced onions, diced tomatoes, chopped olives, salsa, sour cream, all your toppings. And you can either make your soft taco or burrito on low-carb tortillas, or you could put a big pile of shredded lettuce and tomatoes on a plate and pile everything on top of that and have a taco salad. A neat little trick if you want to make something that's unbelievably good for the amount of work it takes is to buy a can of toasted salted pecan halves, or you can toast them and salt them yourself, and get the herb and garlic spreadable cheese, Boursin or Alouette, and put a little bit of the cheese in between two toasted salted pecan halves and sandwich it together. Put them out on a platter. Oh my gosh, they're good. Don't forget about good old deviled eggs, stuffed eggs. Endlessly popular. Everyone loves them. They're super cheap to make. They're filling. So don't neglect the deviled eggs. You can, of course, if you want something out of a cellophane bag, you can grab a bag or two of pork rinds. Personally, I'm not big on just plain pork rinds. But you could make this very simple and unusual recipe that I adore. It's from 500 More Low-Carb Recipes, and it's called Herbert D. Falken's Sweetened Jalapeno Bites. What you do is take a 12-ounce jar of sliced jalapeno peppers, and the original recipe calls for 3/4 cup of Splenda. I would now probably use liquid sucralose, Easy Sweets, to equal 3/4 cup of Splenda. Or you could use one of the new stevia and erythritol blends, whatever your low-carb sweetener of choice is, you want it to equal 3/4 cup of sugar. So 12 ounces of jalapeno peppers and 3/4 cup worth of your sweetener of choice. You dump out the jalapenos, including all the liquid, into a bowl. You stir in the sweetener, pack them all back into the jar, put on the lid, stick it in the fridge for a day or two. Then, when snack time rolls around, you pull out the jar, you grab your cream cheese, get some cream cheese, whipped cream cheese is really good for this, but you can use regular, and grab your pork rinds. Spread the cream cheese on the pork rind, put a few slices of sweetened jalapeno pepper on top, and stuff it in your face. Oh my gosh, it's good. And filling. You're not going to be able to eat, you know, these things forever, but they're awfully good. That whole jar of sweetened jalapeno peppers will only have 18 grams of carbohydrate with 9 grams of fiber for just 9 usable grams of carbohydrate. So that's a neat little snack. You, of course, will want to have lots of cold drinks on hand for the game. Beer is the traditional beverage of choice on game day. You all know that Michelob Ultra is very low carb, as is Miller Lite. You might want to consider, however, Milwaukee's Best Lite. I am convinced Milwaukee's Best Light is Miller Lite in a cheaper can. It's made by the Miller Company, got the same carb count, tastes the same to me, and gosh, it's cheaper. You can also drink Rock Green Light, Coors Light, Corona Light, Amstel Light. They're all under 5 grams a can. You will, of course, want to have non-alcoholic stuff on hand, too. Don't forget to have, if you like diet soda, you want to have your favorite soda on hand. Some iced tea. My favorite is LaCroix Sparkling Water. And one final tip, be sure to sit across the room from the chips, okay? Have fun, and I hope your team wins, whoever it is that's playing. Okay, it's time to hear from another one of our listeners. This time, it's a woman named Mindy, and she's asking about her low-carb challenge.
Hi, Dana. My name's Mindy, and I'm really enjoying your podcast. I'm calling in with kind of a question and what makes us struggle with the low-carb lifestyle. I've been low-carbing since about July, and I've lost about 20 pounds. I've got a good 20 to 30 more to go. And what I find to be the most difficult is wanting things to be sweet. I definitely have a sweet tooth, and that's what has gotten me into this situation with weight and poor health. I don't know if I should try to lose the sweet tooth and stick to more proteins and fats and things like that and try to avoid sweets, or is it okay to just kind of give in to the sugar substitutes and the other kind of foods that you can enjoy that are low carb but also may bring back those old cravings. I also start my day with a big Diet Coke, and I'm wondering if that's kind of a bad idea or if that's okay too. So I'd be grateful to hear your thoughts on that if it's something that it comes up. And again, I really appreciate the show. I can't wait till you're on iTunes. Thanks.
Mindy, that's actually a really interesting question. I admit I don't have a scientific answer for you for what's best, so I'm just going to go with my opinion. But then, you know, being wildly opinionated has served me pretty well in my career so far. I think, personally, that the first and the biggest thing is to get and to keep your carb load low. If you have insulin problems, carbs in and of themselves are addicting. And by dampening that insulin response, I think in the long run, you will start to wean yourself from so much sweet stuff, because you won't be doing it with stuff that's addictive. And if that means using Splenda or erythritol stevia blend or any of the other low-carb sweeteners, then I think that's a useful crutch until you learn to reduce it. I do think that you should be trying to gradually wean yourself away from eating a ton of sweet stuff. I think you should be trying to use it only as a treat rather than as a staple. But I am unconvinced that you need to cut sweets out 100%. Now, I say this as a girl who eats sugar-free chocolate every single day. But on the other hand, I eat maybe an ounce of sugar-free chocolate every single day. I don't eat 5 or 6 bars. I do think there are a few things that can help you to reduce your taste for sweets. And one of them is to slowly back away from the diet soda. This is not just because the diet soda isn't great for you, but also because the manufacturer controls the degree of sweetness. If instead you go for something you make yourself, like iced tea or a cup of coffee or homemade lemonade that you make with stevia or Splenda or whatever your sweetener of choice is, you can gradually reduce the degree of sweetness. And of course, if you drink iced tea or coffee or whatever, you will also get the caffeine you want. You can't do that with soda. You can't reduce the degree of sweetness. You can't choose your own degree of sweetness. And I think that's an important thing. You can also, if you make your own low-carb cookies or cakes or whatever, you can see to it that it's a degree of sweetness you like yourself. I started making my own sugar-free chocolate, and I can control the degree of sweetness, and I've come to like my chocolate very much in the bittersweet range. Please, please tell me that Diet Coke is not your whole breakfast, because another really important thing is to focus on finding the protein and fat dishes that you really, really love. The more that you go for the things that you really adore, like the ribeye, the fried eggs and bacon, the chicken wings, whatever really floats your boat, the less the sweet stuff's going to matter. So that's important too. And finally, do try to buy your sugar-free sweets, the ones you purchase, in portion-controlled form. And if you make sugar-free sweets at home, like you make a sugar-free cake, it's a good idea to cut it up in individual portions, freeze them in individual Ziploc bags, so you only take out one serving at a time. This kind of portion control is very, very helpful. I have learned, for instance, that I do much better buying sugar-free ice cream bars than buying a half gallon of sugar-free ice cream, because I rarely would eat more than one sugar-free ice cream bar. But I have been known to sit down with a half gallon of sugar-free ice cream and a spoon, and that's a very, very bad idea, and I suggest you not do it. Reese's sugar-free mini peanut butter cups are a better choice than a great big sugar-free chocolate bar, because you can take one or two and then not necessarily eat more. The more you can make yourself think before you have another serving, the better. It's also a very good idea to keep the main package out of sight, like keeping the slices of cake in the freezer or the sugar-free cookies in the cookie can on top of the fridge or whatever. Put the main package away before you eat the serving you've taken out. If you leave the cookie can out on the table or the bag of peanut butter cups or whatever, you're far more likely to have more than if you have to take that moment and go back and get them out again. Out of sight really is out of mind. So I hope all of this helps, Mindy. Thanks so much for calling in. Folks, we've been getting a lot of response about the listener challenges, so we're going to do more of these at least on the next show and maybe into the future. But in the meanwhile, I also want to ask the same question I did on the last show. What is your favorite low-carb convenience food? Do you rely on frozen hot wings or hard-boiled eggs or a fast-food mushroom cheeseburger without the bun on top of a side salad? Or do you just make yourself a big plate of fried eggs or an omelet? What food do you turn to when you want a meal in a hurry? Call 412-385-DANA. That's 412-385-3262. And let us know. Okay. It's time to hear the rest of that chat with Adele Hite. As I said, those of you who listened to the last show know Adele was already a successful low-carber before she went to work for Dr. Eric Westman, who is one of America's most important low-carb researchers and one of the co-authors of A New Atkins for a New You. Adele is now working on 3 degrees, including her degree as a dietitian, and says it's been really interesting studying nutrition from the perspective of being a dedicated low-carber. Let's let Adele tell you about it. Shifting away from Dr. Westman to your experiences now, of course, you changed your life and your body. And by the way, folks, I have seen Adele in a bikini. the girl looks fab. You've changed all that through low carbohydrate nutrition. You've watched all these lives at Dr. Westman's clinic being changed too. So you've got this experience behind you. You know on a gut level, on an experiential level, that low carb works, that this is not a joke, that it's not a fad, right, that it's solid. So with that experience behind you, with having, you know, taken the blue pill and seen how deep the rabbit hole goes, what is it like to be in this conservative academic nutrition training? And where do you plan to go with your multiple degrees? And also, I'd like to know what your kind of strangest story is from the conservative academic nutrition training.
So I want to tell you why I decided to make this change. So even in watching the people in the clinic change and get better, I never really thought about this in the larger picture until there was one patient one day who when I was teaching her the diet and telling her about, you know, how to get rid of the sugars and the starches, she burst into tears, which really startled me. I mean, people are very attached to their carbohydrates. So I've always had a little pushback, you know, well, what about this? What about this? You know, can I eat this? But she started crying, and I'm handing her tissues and I'm patting her and I'm trying to understand what's going on. And I finally realized, it dawned on me, she wasn't sad to be giving up carbohydrates. That was not it. She was furious. She was angry. And she looked at me and she said, Adele, you have to find out why we are being told that a low-fat, low-calorie diet is the only way to become healthy. She said, I have been hungry my entire adult life. And now you're telling me I can be healthy without being hungry. And that just broke my heart. And I'm thinking about how we get all concerned about these wide-eyed children in Africa, you know, being hungry. And yet here are all these middle-aged women like me at one time walking around being hungry all the time, trying to get healthy. And we're being told that we don't have enough willpower, that we're not doing it right. And if we get fat, it's our own fault. And so she was the person who inspired me to actually go and find out what is going on. And so I went back to school, and I tell you, I went back with the approach of finding out what was wrong with a low carbohydrate diet. I walked into the doors trying to find the holes in the theory, the holes in the program, why it wouldn't work, why it shouldn't work, why it's wrong. And I have to say that on the science side of the hall, in my biochemistry classes, my physiology classes, my anatomy classes, there's nothing wrong. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the diet. In terms of physiology and biochemistry, it makes perfect sense to try to lower glucose levels and insulin levels through lowering dietary carbohydrate. Protein is the most important macronutrient. Saturated fat is not the bad guy that it's made out to be. None of that holds any water on the science side of the hallway. And then you walk across the hall to policy and public health classes, and the picture changes dramatically. And this has been sort of the down the rabbit hole experience. Now, you have to understand also that UNC, which is where I'm working on my degrees, has a reputation for questioning authority. In fact, one of our state senators one time said that they should put the fence around UNC and just call it a zoo, because all the students there were busy questioning authority and going against the system. So this is actually encouraged at UNC in many regards. So I have one instructor, her name is Amanda Holliday, and she's incredible. She is a registered dietitian, and she does follow the ADA guidelines just like she's supposed to. But when she instructs us in the classroom, she does ask us to go behind the curtain and find out what's going on. So we were given an assignment to look in the American Dietetics Association evidence library and see if there was truly evidence. And she gave us a number of subjects, and I, of course, picked a low-fat diet. And I looked for the evidence to support, the scientific evidence that would support the prescription of a low-carb diet. And I opened up the evidence library, and I scrolled down to the bottom where the list of evidence was supposed to be, and there was no evidence there. It said, no evidence whatsoever. It said, expert opinion. So the ADA bases their low-fat diet prescription on expert opinion. So I'm saying, okay, well, I'm going to dig a little further. Let me look up this expert opinion. So as I began looking up this expert opinion, it really truly was like Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole. You'd have one document that referred to this other document, and then you'd look through the references in that document, and it referred to this other document, and you'd look in that document. Well, it referred back to the first document. Hall of mirrors, where nobody wants to claim responsibility for the diet, and nobody wants to say, oh, here's the actual hard scientific proof for the diet. It's just simply is not there.
And pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Exactly, exactly. And so one of the strange stories, I met this young lady, Dr. Daisy Zamora, and she began her research as a person who really believed in the food pyramid and the food guide and the healthy eating index and all of that. And she began to work on her PhD, and was looking, she had had the same, experience I had, and she couldn't really find the science, that was supporting a low fat diet, but she's like, surely we wouldn't be prescribing this to the entire nation if it didn't work. So she went through a data set and looked at what happened to people who followed, a healthy diet according to the food guide pyramid. And she had this 20-year data set. And what she found is that over the course of 20 years, everybody gains weight. So following a healthy diet, according to the food guide pyramid, over the